Can we create forms of philanthropy that are less colonial in mindset and practices? Can we stop a philanthropic practice that reinforces a mindset of compliance and upward accountability, no matter the good intentions? And can NGOs and philanthropic organizations stimulate homegrown philanthropy? These are questions that John Hecklinger at the Global Fund for Children and his team have been pondering and innovating around for quite a while. In this fascinating episode, you hear John, CEO at the Global Fund for Children, talk about the strategic steps his team took to take on this agenda, and how this work also involved reshaping the ways of working of the fund's board. You will hear how his board had to evolve in mindset, practices, and composition to further this philanthropic stance, and to move to an approach that allowed GFC to become more flexible and responsive to needs. This episode is sure to spark new ideas in your head. Hello, and welcome to NGO Soul and Strategy, the podcast for NGO leaders and managers who look change right in the eye. My name is Tosca Bruno van Vijveken, and I'm the founder and principal consultant at Five Oaks Consulting. I have over 3 decades of experience helping leaders in civil society manage change, invest in cutting-edge leadership development, lead organizational culture change, and strengthen effectiveness. I'm also a thought leader on these issues, including as co-author of the book Between Power and Irrelevance: The Future of Transnational NGOs, which is read by civil society leaders across the globe. If you are such a leader and want to look change right in the eye, this podcast is for you. Hello, everybody. This is NGO Soul and Strategy. Today, I am going to talk with John Hecklinger. I hope I pronounced that name right. You'll tell me in a moment, John. He is the CEO of the Global Fund for Children, and we are going to talk about trust-based philanthropy. We're going to talk about hashtag shift to power and many more things. John and I met about a year ago, and what was striking about that initial conversation to me was how determined but also self-aware John was about how he, but most importantly, Global Fund for Children, seemed to be about being on a path towards what some people call shifting power, and his thoughts about how philanthropy needs to change in order to, quote unquote, decolonize were also of interest to me, since I'm always on the lookout for organizations that try to put their money where their mouth is. So I decided to ask John some more in this interview. So John, very welcome to you.
Yeah, happy to be here. Thanks for asking me, Tosca.
It's going to be a good conversation for sure. John is the president and CEO of the Global Fund for Children. He also is a co-chair of the, or was, I think I should say, for the Alliance for International Youth Development. He was also, and this we will circle back to, the chief program officer at Global Giving, worked in another role there in business development as well, and worked also in the private sector, interestingly enough, as a director of data acquisition, and started out in the Peace Corps in the U.S. volunteer program. John, an obvious first question. Tell us a little bit about the nature of the Global Fund for Children.
Yeah, I mean, the Global Fund for Children, we occupy a really kind of interesting and unique, you know, space in the whole kind of philanthropy and global development ecosystem. You can think about us as a bit of an intermediary. And I say that very self-consciously, because I think in this era where we're actually trying to, you know, shift the way things are done, not everybody is ready to do that themselves all the time. And so they need help. And so what Global Fund for Children does is we find these amazing, grassroots organizations all over the world working with children and youth, and increasingly led by youth. And we provide, multiple years of flexible support paired with highly tailored, kind of capacity development, services. We also, and this has been a new, practice of ours in the last several years, we, gather organizations together and launch them as, cohorts. And so when they're, together in a particular geographic area, working on a particular problem, we assemble organizations that are tackling different aspects of that challenge, that have the, desire to, work with others and learn with others and be more powerful, together. And we typically will have a staff member who's also, from that region and, deeply involved in addressing the issues that the cohort is also addressing, to really accompany, the cohort and become, when it works well, almost a virtual member of their organizations. So very, very deeply involved, developing a lot of trust with those organizations. And I think we've experienced some nice growth over the past few years. I think because funders, and most of our funding comes from family foundations, corporate foundations, larger private foundations, they're sensing that, hey, the way we've been operating isn't, really living up to our aspirations. We want to be more community led, but we are not staffed or geared up to do that. So by working with us, providing the funding through Global Fund for Children that ultimately supports that, flexible funding for, truly grassroots organizations, we can be, an intermediary, not just of the funding to move money from point A to point B, although that is a very useful function that other organizations do. But we're an intermediary of trust and of knowledge, and we can kind of transform what for us is more restricted funding coming from a more traditional foundation, but magically transforming that into more flexible funding for organizations on the ground, and then taking on the responsibility of, rolling all the interesting things that happen up into, reports, to that funder. So we have the possibility of, really working closely with, the organizations we support, to put in, reporting and learning practices that are actually meaningful to them, and then rolling that into a report that also satisfies a donor, which, may have more specific, requirements that, that they want to have fulfilled, by their grantees. And so that's the top line description of the spot we occupy in the ecosystem.
I'm going to immediately diverge from what I thought I was going to ask you by first asking you, you used the word intermediary right in the beginning, mm-hmm. and a little bit of the irony is, but I think it makes a lot of sense. I know you're going to explain this to us, is that, as you know, the role of being an intermediary for what I call a Global North founded NGO has been questioned more and more for the last 10 years, at least, right? And yet the way you framed it, Global Fund for Children is a very useful intermediary. That then, any more comments on that would be welcome. But also, I was interested to hear how you said you are, if I understood it right, the foundations that give to you as an intermediary, quote unquote, allow you to make their potentially more rigid requirements more flexible. Why are they willing to do that with you? And how do you make that translation, if you will?
Mm-hmm. I mean, the most important thing is that everybody's interests are aligned, from the organizations that we pull together into these cohorts to our ability to actually engage authentically with those organizations, and also the aim of the funder. So if the funder, say, is interested one of our biggest programs is, funded by Lego Foundation. It's a partnership to educate all kids. So it's, for younger kids, organizations all over the world. No surprise, working on, learning through play of various types. With the idea of reconnecting young people to education in the post-pandemic environment. Lego was interested in exploring what that looks like and supporting that all over the world. What are the grassroots doing, through play to help kids get reconnected, and what might we do to drive more resources directly to them, but without, the networks and the on the ground knowledge of working with local organizations that we have. Certainly a core interest of ours as well, that we had independently kind of cooked up as a real priority for us. And then also having relationships, not yet funding relationships, but knowing the landscape around the world and knowing that there are these organizations out there also using this approach. So it kind of naturally fits together. So we're not out there saying, hey, I know you're a grassroots organization and you're working on a particular issue, but could you also do learning through play? Yeah, we're not doing that. What we're doing is we're making sure that alignment with the funder's goals and with the organization and with GFC already exists, so that yes, the funding is bound. It should be about learning through play with a certain age group. And if we find organizations that are authentically already working on that, then that becomes less restrictive. It doesn't push them in different directions. It amplifies, the work that they're already hoping to do and hoping to do better, and may not have the funding to do because they're busy with other projects over here to keep the bills paid. And so that's the alignment that's essential to make sure that, yes, the funding is flexible, but it is bound, but those boundaries are boundaries within which those organizations have already decided to work.
I see. So it's about a very careful matching, if you will. Now, you mentioned to me before that Global Fund for Children, at least historically, has also done what you called imaginative media work, books, film, photography, etc., children's stories. Some of this work you have not continued in the same way, but dignified storytelling is still important. How does that fit into your theory of change?
Yeah, so a part of the original idea of Global Fund for Children was as a bit of a social enterprise, that these books that our founder, Maya Ejmera, wrote and co-wrote with various folks, really just charming books about and for young people, kind of opening their eyes to the realities of what it's like for kids around the world, and all the challenges and the beauty that go along with that. At one point before my time, the decision was made to kind of discontinue publishing those books. But there are many of them that are still in print and being revised. And we have a great relationship with the publishing company, and, a modest amount of the revenue still comes to GFC to this day. Mm-hmm. So that was, part of it was like telling those really authentic global stories to, not showing all the problems and how, children are hurt by all these things around the world, although they are, but really focusing on the power, the agency, the resilience, of young people. And that's what we're really committed to doing in terms of dignified storytelling. Our communications are really rooted in the hypothesis that progress is happening. Young people have power. And it's important to tell the stories of that power. Yes, they are not shying away from the difficult situations they're in, but in everything we do, you know, how we picture the young people, the permissions we get, even camera angles, we're not looming over them, and as if we have the power, but you know, they're the strong ones and we're there to support. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, that is not always the best way to trigger someone to give. We've all seen television commercials and received direct mail that don't use that, that dignified storytelling approach. I am stubbornly dedicated to whether it works for fundraising or not. It's these stories of power, of agency, of change, where young people really are the change makers and the leaders that need to be told. Mm-hmm. And part of our theory of change is that, you know, as young people become leaders within these organizations, they are much, much more likely to be able to make those changes that they see need to happen in their communities than we are. And so the sum total of that, that real, really rooted brilliance and ingenuity and innovation and power is really what makes the big difference in the world. And it's important to articulate that.
I loved what you said. Progress is happening and young people have agency. Now, you worked at Global Giving before. That organization in its own right, in my view, played an interesting, maybe I want to call it trend-shaping role in civil society when it was founded. Tell us a little bit more about how you think Global Giving introduced innovation into the sector, and what did you learn there that you brought into the Global Fund for Children? I'm just curious. Maybe there's not much of an angle, but I wanted to explore it.
Well, it's funny because, since my Peace Corps days, I had various experiences where I was just really frustrated that, why are these amazing ideas from all these people that I've met so difficult to fund or to get, if it's not funding, get whatever other resources they need. Certainly, someone who needs $2,000 to do an initial printing of a study guide for students in a particular country and to see if that would work, somebody would be willing to pay that $2,000 to give that idea a try. And I had this idea in my head I if I won the lottery or whatever, I would go around the world and really figure out, see the guy I met in Belize whose boat and flute had been washed away in a hurricane and was now out of work. Somebody out there, I didn't have the resources at the time, but somebody would certainly help him get a boat and a flute. If you could communicate that need and that chain of trust. So yes, this is not, just some random person trying to scam the world. This is actually a real person who has a history, who has the potential to get their life back on track with just a little nudge here or there. But we now know that as crowdfunding. But in 2005, when I joined Global Giving, it was just this idea that, wait a minute, that's a brilliant idea. I've had that idea and I'm so happy that, somebody's actually trying it. I really should join that organization. That makes perfect sense. But it was actually pretty radical at the time.
Yeah.
The headline of early GSC days was it's the eBay of philanthropy, a better way to connect buyers and sellers of social impact. And, crowdfunding was not a term, but that's indeed what we were building. Was a way to kind of turn the usual way things happen on its head, to start with the ideas of the people, closest to the challenge and to give them a platform, to get those ideas funded and tried. And using a very tech forward approach, which we now know as crowdfunding. So and Global Giving was, the first kind of, global crowdfunding platform for nonprofits. Now there are a lot of options out there. So it was a radical idea ahead of its time. And then the world kind of caught up And the growth that global giving has experienced, I think, is some evidence that, you know, generally people are coming around to a different way of thinking that, well, what do I know about, you know, what's going to work for those people? You know, no, let me be supportive of the great ideas that bubble up in some place, sometimes from, you know, not the usual, most of the time from not the usual suspects, from, right, you know, yes, the really people on the margins.
Right. So really citizen to citizen, peer to peer. That's what I thought was so lovely about global giving, when it opened the door, and I myself definitely also give through them. So let's talk a little bit about philanthropy as a, I don't really like the word system. It's so overused. But you have observations about philanthropy when it's done as a system. You said in the past it's colonial in mindset and in practice, and it reinforces systems of oppression. How do you see that linked to what Global Fund for Children tries to do differently?
But I think and I say that, and knowing that just about everybody in this system is operating in good faith with good intentions. But the sum total of that just has a tendency to perpetuate the system as it is. Because all the incentives are, have been, and many continue to be, aligned around what the donor is most interested in. And how can I make sure that the recipients of my money aren't perpetrating fraud on me? You know, what is my risk as a funder in funding you, nascent organization, you know, someplace else in the world? And I think that compliance and upward accountability first mindset leads to all sorts of problematic practices where the incentives line up to say, sure, you want this work done, I will do that work, and I will report back to you on the work that was done. And then maybe at some point we evaluate whether it worked or not, but it doesn't really matter because now we're on to the next thing. And you're kind of closing out the opportunity for real messy, complex, you know, systemic change, which has a tendency to kind of resist the more, you know, linear, you know, yeah, the more traditional linear expectations about how things work. I put in this money, you deliver this project, the project delivers this impact, and then we all celebrate and move on. Everybody needs to have some idea of what am I trying to accomplish in the world? What are the things I need to, in order to try the things I need to try in order to accomplish what I'm accomplishing? So I'm not saying that there's no space at all. I mean, we have a theory of change, and it helps to kind of organize your thoughts and your work and to describe how you think about that. And it's that level of sophisticated thinking that actually exists very naturally in many, many, many grassroots organizations around the world, that, but not in a way that neatly ties up, you know, into a log frame or theory of change in a way that's like perfectly recognizable to many funders. So you have, so then that creates just blockages. You don't have access, you know, to, if you're an organization, particularly in certain parts of the world, to the funding that you need, even though you are a tremendous organization with an extremely sophisticated approach, great ways of sort of assessing your progress and impact, but you're in rural Nigeria, and you know, there are biases against you because of where you happen to sit, and that scares many donors off because they're worried about their money, and that's something we're trying to fix. We're trying to, really start with, the brilliant ideas. Come up with like, okay, what organizations do we know that are in this together, potentially in this together, then who are the funders out there who can kind of buy into this idea that has authentically bubbled up, you know, from the communities themselves? And I, you know, it's taken to the extreme. You know, you have, again, with great intentions, some of the excesses of, the effective altruism way of thinking. Like, okay, I have made all of this money. I want to do as much good as I possibly can with this money. Again, great intention, noble idea. But then ultimately, if I really will have that lens on, you know, the best use of my money, there are only a very few organizations that are going to stand up to that. Well, if I can save 100 lives for $100, why would I not do that? Well, because not every effort that's going to save all of those lives can be wrapped up tidily in a randomized control trial. And so the danger is that way of thinking kind of crowds out the more exploratory and more emergent, you know, kind of impact that really happens, you know, taken to the absurd extreme. You know, if we spend all of, you know, the money hunting asteroids that may, you know, kill us all, and we don't work on access to education, you know, maybe the girl in Uganda who's the one who invented the way to detect the asteroid doesn't get her chance and we get hit by the asteroid anyway.
Yeah.
So you've got to have both approaches. There's room for both. But I think what we're trying to do is to, you know, stand up for long-term system change that doesn't happen always in predictable ways. To stand up for communities that, you know, determine the things that they want to work on and then assist them in ways that are appropriate.
I see. And you also, as an organization, wish to encourage homegrown domestic philanthropy. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, it's a... I think what we're trying to do is to look at, I mean, because communities have many, many, many assets that they don't always think of leveraging first. And so we're really looking at ways that we can work with organizations that help catalyze efforts within communities to really make the most of the assets that are already there and to really, you know, gain strength on their own. And yes, certainly, I just visited a community in Sierra Leone that had worked very closely with one of our partners, and, you know, they wanted to build a school. And the initial, you know, assumption was, well, we need the government to come in and build the school. How can we do that? But then they eventually realized, well, shoot, we can just build it. Yeah, they needed a little bit of money to, you know, put the tin roof on the top, but everything else was locally sourced. And ultimately, they got the, you know, government approval to, you know, run the school, and the government's very supportive. But it was really the community doing it themselves, leveraging assets in ways that they hadn't initially thought of doing. But through, you know, dynamic and complex work with a partner of ours in that area, they were able to do, you know, something pretty remarkable, and are now thinking about, okay, what can we do next?
Interesting. So you primarily work, let's say, on promoting and stimulating homegrown philanthropy within the setting of the work with partner organizations and program participants. You're not so much working on, let's say, the infrastructure for homegrown philanthropy in countries or regions, is it?
Not so directly. I think, yeah, if you look, that's part of the work I was doing at Global Giving, was trying to explore how, you know, a global platform could complement local mechanisms for local philanthropy. And those exist and are powerful in some cases. In some cases, they've gone in pretty disempowering and exploitative directions. I think the practice of philanthropy, is not uniquely a North-South phenomenon.
Nope, not at all.
People without a lot of resources, percentage-wise, tend to be more generous than people with a lot of resources.
Absolutely.
And there are many local untapped resources for sure. It's work that we're doing, we're supportive of, but it's not like we are, kind of setting up mini Global Fund for Children's to try to do this in a bunch of places.
Okay, I just wanted to understand a little bit more. Now, we also talked in the past about the work that you and your teams had to do with your board to move towards a more trust-based philanthropy. And that was of interest to me as well. What you said, we needed to encourage our board friends to become more courageous. Tell us a little bit about the transition that the board, that you wanted the board to encourage to go through, how that went, where you are now, and what is still work to be done, if any.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, and I've been with the organization for a little over 5 years now, and it's just a very different environment on the board. I think there were a lot of really very big questions we were wrestling with when I first arrived, and even around some of the work that, seems, typical to us now was a little bit edgier at the time. We were edging more into supporting organizations that held, advocacy in various ways as, part of their core mission. And some folks on the board, for them, advocacy translated into, okay, are they going out and protesting? And is that a risk for us reputationally? Mm-hmm. When in reality, advocacy yes, it can be, advocating in the political realm. It can also just be working in communities to change attitudes about various things. Doesn't have to be contentious. Sometimes it is contentious.
It has to be.
And so kind of reaching an understanding that, well, it's a pretty typical trajectory within an organization to start off, okay, what can I do to alleviate this problem that's in front of me right now? And then at some stage to say, well, why do I keep dealing with this problem? What is wrong with the system that I need to change in order, really solve this problem? And inevitably that leads to, working with other organizations, maybe at the policy level, maybe there's the community change level. But it gets away from, wait a minute, I thought we were just delivering stuff to kids.
Yeah.
it never has been as simple as that. But I think the board, has really, really deepened its appreciation of how change really happens. And we've gotten a lot more in sync. We used to operate kind of like a more traditional foundation where we would have a couple of big grant dockets a year, and we would, ask the board to kind of approve them. But when organizations have urgent needs and opportunities come, then you can't always wait, up to 6 months for the next docket to come together. And then at that point, everything's kind of fully baked anyway. So
yeah,
if something goes wrong at that point and someone has a question, then you're kind of back at square one. So we all realized that we were locked into a system that didn't really work. So just moving away from the board approving two dockets a year to having a much more meaningful engagement on the overall kind of programmatic strategy, from grant making to capacity development, and looking at what the portfolio looks like in a very deep dive once a year and a mini dive another time during the year, has actually been a lot more engaging for the board, because they're learning more about our approaches before, everything is baked into a docket. And so there's more of an opportunity to shape, and to keep an eye on the work. And it also creates a lot more flexibility, for us to be able to, respond when, emergencies happen in the world, whether it's, COVID pandemic or the war in Ukraine, any of the floods in Pakistan or any of the other challenges that our partners face and that we raise money for.
So at the one level, you've been able to, as an organization, to become more flexible and responsive. On the other hand, the board is actually more strategically engaged than it was in the past, when it was primarily rubber stamping to what you call fully baked dockets.
Yeah. And I think that's kind of a marker of a trust-based approach. The board being very informed, building that trust that they understand, you know, where the staff is heading and where we are now, which is freeing, because we've built that trust, which then makes it a lot easier, you know, for us, you know, to be more flexible, you know, with our partners in terms of timing, in terms of when things happen. And we can be lighter in terms of what we actually expect, you know, from them during application and reporting process, because we're not, you know, always having to extract, you know, information to make sure we have every line on the docket filled in.
Yeah. Interesting. Did this also generate new perspectives on who Global Fund for Children needed to have on the board?
Yeah, I think, you know, from the start, the board was pretty conscious that, you know, we needed to, you know, add different perspectives. You know, and it's in my mind, it's because we are an organization that raises funds. We have to have a good mix of people who are, you know, really deeply understanding of our particular role in the ecosystem and really understand our work at a deep level. We also have to have people who have links into financing, you know, the work we do, because it doesn't happen if we don't, you know, have money coming through, and to really have and I think that's really enriched the board conversations, because everyone's getting smarter together. You know, we've asked, we have an alumni partner of ours, Maya, from Serbia, who's now on our board. You know, we're about to welcome ex officio chair of our Youth Leadership Council to the board. And we've carved out a budget to welcome other leaders from the Global South, areas of the world where we don't have great representation on our board, to be able to participate and make a trip at least once a year to join a board meeting in person. So we're being really conscious of just making sure that we have as many perspectives as we can, which is, yeah, a lot. I mean, it's just more interesting and more fun for everybody. And it happens to be more effective as well.
Tell me more about more fun. I'm curious what you mean by that.
Well, we're able to have just more meaningful conversations about, yeah, we last year we were in the cycle of kind of creating a 5-year vision, you know, for GFC, and having different perspectives on that vision was great. And I think, you know, our board members are all extremely intellectually curious about the work we do, and it's actually difficult to like really directly connect, because so much of the work we do is not in Washington, D.C. or New York. You know, actually, a lot of it is in London and the UK at this point, but it's hard. You know, it's not like we're a food bank where you can go and stock shelves. And so to kind of make it more real for folks and to provide that, that nuanced perspective of the work we do, the feedback so far, in recent years has been, wow, the information we're getting is meaningful, is at the right level, and we're having better conversations about how we, you know, how we steer the organization.
I see. And you've talked about how the work with the board, the evolution that the board was willing to go through, changed in the composition of board, that all shaped and changed to some extent board culture, if you will. How about the culture in the rest of the organization? Many of us are rhetorically entirely on board with what you're describing as kind of broad kind of paradigm shifts. But when the rubber hits the road and when it affects our own roles in the organization, our jobs, our futures, et cetera, our decision-making rights, et cetera, it can get more, the picture gets more blurry. Can you tell us a little bit about, from a culture shaping perspective, this journey? What did that mean for staff and for you and your relationship with staff and so on?
Yeah, our staff composition has changed dramatically over the past 5 years. So we've gone from a very much a Washington, D.C. headquarters mentality and a satellite team in the UK. And a couple of people around the world to, 60 people in 20 countries, or thereabouts. Mm-hmm. And that is really amazing. And also challenging to make sure that everybody is, supported and compensated equitably and have good onboarding processes to make sure everyone is really aligned, with the vision, with our plans. And so it's a great challenges to have. And we're frankly catching up to ourselves a little bit in some of those respects. Mm. But the staff composition now more accurately reflects the way we want to work in the world and how we want to be perceived by our grantee partners around the world, which is the most important thing. And the feedback from our partners has been really, really good as we've been making these changes. As CEO of the organization, thinking about, HR compliance in 20 countries and making sure everybody is globally and equitably compensated with respect to different markets, but not taking the different markets as they are, because the markets are as they are because of the system that we're pushing against. Those are really, in some ways, incredibly privileged problems to be able to work through. If we're going to succeed and truly live up to our vision and values, those are some of the internal things that we've taken on and are tackling.
Interesting. Yeah, all very complex within them. But for lack of time, let me move on. If you and I now, towards the end of our interview, can zoom out a little bit. If you think about how the whole discourse in the sector around decolonizing aid, anti-racism, DEI, et cetera, what do you see, not just for Global Fund for Children, but also for other organizations in the sector? What are still appropriate roles for Global North founded NGOs, both those that are more of a foundation type like yours, as well as those that have other categories of work, if mm-hmm. you will?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a pragmatist. So I'm realizing that for some period of time, we're going to be working largely within the system as it is. And so if GFC can shape that system and drive more resources more equitably to more local leadership and all the different shapes and forms that takes, I'll take that for now, because the alternative is that it doesn't, and we may as well work on that in the moment. And yet it's still within the system that we ultimately all want to disrupt. So we've gotten to do a few things that point in in dramatically different directions. So the team now is dreaming up some experiments, some ideas that we would undertake in particular communities in the world where we have particularly strong relationships that might point in dramatically different directions.
Such as
what does it really look like to be 100% community driven, where we're really, really, really not making any decisions, just catalyzing a process. And maybe there's actually no money involved. there's no project. There's no like flexible funding. There's just work that we're doing, together. And yes, adding perspective that we've, gathered from around the world, but who is with us in dreaming up some fundamentally different thing, which I cannot yet articulate what that looks like, because that would be my idea. But what do we need to do to really, really explore that? We made good moves in that direction through, very participatory grant making mechanisms involving youth and taking ourselves out of decision making at every opportunity. And those are all good learning processes for us, pointing in really interesting directions. Mm-hmm. And yet I think there's something else out there. And I don't know what that looks like yet, but I'm looking forward to exploring that with some other intrepid peers.
Interesting. Yes, I'm sure that others will be watching to see what Global Fund for Children as you clearly are trying to be at the front of the pack in terms of, or a little bit of a vanguard role in terms of your corner of philanthropy. So I admire that. John, if people want to know more about you and about the Global Fund for Children and these directions that you're trying to shape, right? These sector shaping roles that you're trying to play, where should they go?
Yeah, I would suggest the blog area at globalfundforchildren.org. There is a lot of great learning material, some of the research that we've done, things that we're trying, amazing stories of our partners, stories about the team. So a lot of great stuff in that blog section that you might not otherwise gravitate toward. And with me, LinkedIn is the best way. Just look me up there. And if you want to connect, make sure you just say you viewed the podcast.
Listened or viewed the podcast. Okay, we will definitely put that in the show notes. So with that, John, thank you for all those insights. You've given me new food for thought. And thank you, listeners. If you found this podcast stimulating, then be sure to check out other episodes in the podcast. You can find several episodes on efforts to shift roles for Global North founded NGOs that we just talked about, shift power, localized development. For instance, let me point you to episode 22 with Dorothy Nyambi at MEDA. And my colleague Esther Kwaku and myself have also undertaken recently a small qualitative benchmarking study for 17 civil society organizations who are a member of the International Civil Society Center on the extent to which they have already shifted power and what their next steps on their horizon are or perhaps should be. You can provide a link or we will provide a link to the summary of that report in the show notes as well. All of this you can find on my website, fiveoaksconsulting.org with the number 5, and on the YouTube channel. Subscribe to the email list and you'll always be the first to know. So with that, I look forward to talking with you again next time on NGO Soul and Strategy. Thanks for listening to my podcast. If you valued the content, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify so that other leaders of social change organizations can find it too. And if you want to learn more, have a look at my website, fiveoaksconsulting.org.
where you will find blog posts, recordings of interviews with me, as well as information about my co-authored book, Between Power and Irrelevance, The Future of Transnational NGOs. If you sign up for my email list, you will receive a free sneak peek at the book. Or feel free to email me at tosca@fiveoaksconsulting.org or contact me through my website. And follow me on social media, LinkedIn, Twitter, and Facebook. Till we talk again at NGO Soul and Strategy, the podcast for NGO leaders and managers who look change right in the eye.